contacted Sydney. There was 2,000 people from Mali and told them it's unacceptable. 12 people in a meeting, out of which two spoke. We're all department officials, and we kept it at four. So I'm pleading to Cindy that, Peter Paul, that, you know, this, unless there's special circumstances, up to four people is fine. Half an hour. Let me welcome Pinky back. We know you've had some challenges, and we're pleased to see you. And wish you well. And we understand if you have to leave early. We understand. I'm not a hard slave driver. I'm just a slave driver. And I also want to say that we're very, very pleased. Let me start with this. We want to thank very, very warmly the Stelfon Evals. Sorry? The Stelfon Evals for their excellent service to this committee. As members know, I think we should applaud, actually. It's very, very good. I don't know why you're applauding, because you don't know that, but I'll explain to the members. And on behalf of Kandi also, I want to applaud you. The Stelfon Evals has been excellent as a committee secretary. She's been temporarily with us, and she's performed her duties remarkably well. Notwithstanding issues were raised yesterday, which I'll come back to later. So, I'll be very grateful to you. I will formally write to you and your unit manager to thank him and you for the services you rendered to this committee. Also, very pleased to welcome back Peter Paul Mbele, who was in our committee and abandoned us because there were circumstances that dictated he goes to another committee. But we are very pleased that he's back with us, and he's also an excellent committee secretary, and he knows this area quite well also because, like fellows in appropriations, he is his COPA before he came here. So welcome back, Peter Paul, and hope you will have a rewarding stay with our committee, notwithstanding the fact that we now have a meeting with him. And he was actually having a happy time when he was here before. I'm just talking about, I'm just cheating, David, in our scripts, right? There are members here who may not appreciate that I'm just being facetious and cheating. So we welcome all of you from the public entity before us, and we hand over to you. But before I go on as an in-house announcement further, I must make an invisible rollout. So I may Peter Paul will do it again at the end. The Friday Portfolio Committee joint meeting on base erosion and profit shifting and added illicit financial flows is taking place as planned on the 11th, that's Friday. I think we've done the draft program. Is that right? Have you distributed it? Yeah, so we've distributed it, right? In consultation with various other portfolio committees, what's clear is trade and industry, mineral and mineral resources and ourselves, which are the main committees, will participate fully. Economic development is also on. The other committees, appropriations, said they will be there. So five out of the seven who agreed today will be there. In labor, labor got something else on. Small business and science and technology will send one or two individuals. I want to tell you that truly in class will bring eight portfolio committees understandably together. But we are going ahead with the joint sitting, and it's a workshop type situation, so there's no decisions going to be taken, and there are free flow exchanges between the members and the representatives. Present will be National Treasury, SARS, FICA, representative departments of mineral resources, trade and industry, economic development, and possibly other committees. Okay, and you have the program before you. It's a draft program, and it flows from the previous meeting, joint meeting that was held. Okay, so that's on Friday. Next week, we have been given exemption from the provincial business. So we'll be sitting with the public hearing as agreed, and the, on the program, the negotiation for it is the fucking report from National Treasury, the day before. But there's some difficulty about the DG's availability, so my office around the week thereafter. On the matter of the Money Bills Act, I regret to say that because of the sitting of the Constituent Assembly on Women and the scrapping of sittings for the NDOP, and because of a change in the Appropriations Committee program, the week thereafter, we were going to sit the Money Bills Act amendment with committees from both houses, NDOP and NA, the four committees concerned, regrettably, because of all these changes, shall the DS pleaded with us to postpone it so we'll be sitting early in the fourth quarter with the money bills amendment proposals. Then I also need to let you know, yesterday today is the deadline. Do people submit all their questions so that we forward it to the SAA management and the minister. I speak to the minister on the meeting last week. He's agreed that he would come. He's very keen to bring the shareholder management compact, shareholder compact with us, to us. So we will arrange an appropriate sitting day in the last quarter of this year with SAA. Now, given those of you who are relatively new to the committee, the MTDPS process is dictated by the Money Bills Act. We are very limited. It's the committee secretaries that just do that. It's an intensive process. It's frankly frenetic and unduly onerous on us because we're not able to exercise our effective oversight. So we are looking into the Money Bills Act amendments to facilitate that. But the Treasury tells us that actually they themselves have been toying with that because they want us to be more effective in our oversight. But it's going to be very difficult unless we move all the dates forward. It is very hard to actually give us more time beyond the 9 days, I think Peter Holden is saying. So those are all the enough announcements. I don't know if anybody has questioned us on the program over the next immediate period. No? Fine. Let's move over to yourself. You'll introduce your team. We have a new CEO. You've just joined, is that correct? About 2 months ago, 3 months ago?
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. So you introduce yourself and your team. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Honorable Chairman. Thank you for inviting us to this committee. As you rightly pointed out, I will introduce the team. Let me first of all say I note the comments regarding the composition of the team, and we will respect that, and thank you for pointing that out to us. I've joined Chipao on the 1st of August, and I'm pleased that we do have a strong team with us. We have, I think the names are up there, Eddie DeWitt, who is the General Manager of Legal Services, Cliff Ferguson, Senior Manager, Strategy and Policy, Herman Creo, Chief Information Officer, Jim Moran, Acting Chief Operations Officer, Kediboni Mahaye, General Manager, Customer Relationships Management, Mongezi Nkabisa, General Manager, National Treasury Program, Kumzila Mdam, who is our Acting Chief Financial Officer, Safisa Kumalo, who is the Senior Manager, Monitoring and Evaluation, and Shidi Ikening, who is our Chief Risk Officer. So we do have that team at your disposal today, and I trust they all will be participating actively in our deliberations today. Mr. Chairman, just to take one step back and examine the legislative mandate of JIPA. JIPA is a government component established in terms of the Public Service Act of 1994 with effect from 1 April 2010. That was the date in which we became a separate legal entity from the GPF. Its mandate is to relocation the administration and other relevant services to the Government Employees Pension Fund and the National Treasury in accordance with the administration and service level agreements concluded with JIPA and the National Treasury. So we are part of your financial cluster, but more specifically we are part of the pensions trio of PRC, GPF, and JIPA. So PRC, of course, does the management of the assets. GPF is a separate legal entity in terms of the fund, and we are the administration arm as JIPA. And JIPA ensures effective, transparent, accountable, and coherent governance of pension funds currently administered. Honorable Chairman, if I could move to the next slide. So just to give you a bird's eye view in terms of the funds that we currently administer, our largest fund is the GPF, which is administered in terms of the GPF law of 1996. But over and above that, we administer the Temporary Employees Pension Fund, as well as the Associated Institution Pension Fund, and also the post-retirement medical aid subsidies as provided for and related by the Public Service Coordinating Bargaining Council, the military pensions in terms of the Military Pensions Act of 84, the injury and duty payments in terms of the Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Disease Act. This is, of course, in terms of the public sector, special pensions in terms of the Special Pension Act, and other and VIP funds, such as those funds dealing with judges, past state presidents, etc. Honorable Chairman, in terms of our vision is really to be the leading people-centric benefits administrator in government. And our mission is to serve clients by paying benefits accurately and timelessly and later on in the presentation we'll give you some yardsticks in that respect. Our values are something we hold extremely dear to us. We are in the business of paying pensions, so we have a tangible product which is administration, but over and above that we have the intangible product of trust and integrity. So our values talk to that, and those values are transparency, respect, integrity, courtesy, and of course service excellence to all our clients and stakeholders. We talk to the NDP in the sense that we want to create an effective civil service, we want to fight corruption, and we want to be at the forefront of service delivery. But to go to the next slide, Mr. Chairman, our goals are effectively to deliver an administration that is effective, efficient, and economical. If I drill down a little bit more in terms of objectives, the first objective is to pay the right amount. As per the legal entitlement of our beneficiaries, in terms of the laws of the land and, of course, the rules of the fund. We also need to pay these amounts to the right person. We need to pay these benefits at the right time, and we do have service-level agreements that talk to the time scales. We need to employ the right people who are competent, performance-driven, and caring. And, of course, we need to administer the funds at the right cost. So we've got to benchmark our costings. On the chairperson, if I can take you to the next slide, that just talks to the scale of JIPRA. 93% of our budget comes from the GEPF, and the remaining 7% comes from the National Treasury Program. We have huge outreach in terms of our membership and those individuals we serve. We have our database, 1.2 million active members. Those are people who are contributing, and a further 500,000 people who are in receipt of benefits. So all in all, JIPRA's outreach to South Africa as a whole is in the region of 1.8 million people. But to take you down to Section 5 and just tie it up with Section 7, and it's something we will come a little bit later to. At the end of financial year 31st March 2015, we received about 57 billion rand in terms of revenue. That is from the GPS, but we paid out 78 billion rand in benefits. And we'll go a little later in the presentation as to why we see this tilt. Because historically, the benefits have traditionally been lower than the actual revenues collected. So we'll speak about why we've seen the change in dynamics. And of course, we service more than 470 government departments. Honorable Chairperson, in terms of the briefing, we need to talk to the performance of our entity. We group them in two. The first one is support services, 1.1 to 1.5, and the second part is the customer-facing services. In terms of sub-program 1.1, which is what we call, which is the corporate services, I just want to point out that overall for this year we have 23 annual indicators, but some of these indicators are actually measured annually. So in terms of benchmarks, we have 16 benchmarks which we have measured at the end of quarter one, which is at the end of June 2015. In terms of our corporate services, we had four measures today. We've seen a mixed bag there, where, for example, in terms of carrying out employee satisfaction survey, we've done incredibly well. In terms of having a governance framework, we've achieved that goal. We partially achieved the reduction of carbon footprint goal. But where we have fallen short is in terms of the work skills training plan. So we've not achieved that one. We are in the process of addressing that in the second quarter, and we hope to see an improvement in terms of that goal or measurable which was not achieved in terms of program 1.1, which is corporate services. Honorable Chairman, if I could take you then to the second indicator, which is the financial indicator. We have two indicators here that I measured this quarter, and we have achieved both of them. One is to identify findings that will result in a clean audit, and also provide input in terms of the costing model for benchmarking our expenses and services that we provide. So I'm pleased to say in program 1.2, which is our financial services area, we've achieved both those objectives. In terms of 1.3, which is business enablement and modernization, we actually had only one deliverable there for quarter one, which is really to set up a pilot phase for self-service. Honourable Chairman, if I could just talk to that point. Part of what we're doing at Jupa is a modernization program, and one of those pilot programs is actually a self-service mechanism where members can walk into a walk-in center and retrieve information and update their information. So we're actually piloting that on a small scale at the moment. We've achieved that aspect. In terms of 1.4, which is the CEO's office, that is really, if we look at the 16 deliverables, we've achieved 11 of them. So by implication, we've underachieved on this because of the 16, we've achieved 11, so we've achieved 69%. If you look at our overall target for the first quarter, it was 82%. So if the other indicators move up the line, then this indicator will also be achieved. But currently, in terms of the CEO's office, which looks at the overall performance of the organization, we're sitting at 69%. And then in terms of the last support service, internal audit, we had one indicator there, which is the implementation of the audit plan. We've achieved 73% there, which is that 8 out of the 11 audits we achieved. So we have a partial achievement in terms of then the internal audit support service function. In terms of then moving to program 2.1, which is our national treasury services, I think I'm very pleased to say that of the three indicators which we measured in quarter one, we've exceeded our targets here, which is paying the benefits accurately, complying to the SLA, and also paying the benefits on time. All three of those objectives within the National Treasury Program, we've achieved there. In terms of Program 2.2, which is GEPF, again, we've got four annual indicators, of which three are measured on a quarterly basis. We have achieved the goal of paying benefits accurately, and we have achieved the goal of complying to the SLA. Where we have fallen short there is that we had a target of paying 75% of benefits within 45 days, which is in terms of the SLA. We were at 71%. Honorable Chairman, we will talk a little bit later on in terms of the reasons for that. And also we'll look at the stats in terms of the number of claims that have come through into Jupa. And then the last area is the client's relationship management. We had one target there when we achieved that target. We wanted 75% compliance to the SLA. This talks to areas such as our walk-in center, call center, etc. So we used to say that we've achieved that target. So overall, of the 23 annual indicators, we've had 16 indicators which can be measured this quarter, of which we've achieved 11. So an overall 69% achievement in terms of the overall scorecard. Our intention and our target was 82%. Honourable Chairman, if I could just speak to the next slide. This is really talking to the budgets. As you can see, for the years 2013, 2014, as well as 2014-15, we had budgets of just below 800,000 and just above 900,000, and then we see a considerable increase in the budget, and that really talks to the modernization program. And later on in the slides, we will give some examples of what exactly that modernization program entails and what we've achieved thus far. We can see after the substantial increase in that budget, it does scale off and eventually does decrease over time. So that talks to a lot of the capital expenditure we are having in terms of the modernization program. If I just look specifically at this year, we do have a challenge that a lot of our programs within our modernization program did not kick in the quarter one. So we do have an underspending of 214 million in that respect. These are the figures that have been updated at the end of July, I believe, end of August 2015. So we are catching up in terms of the spending, and we believe that by year ending, the barriers will not be that much. It's simply a question of a delay in implementation of these programs. If I could hop to the next slide, which I think is a very interesting slide, it talks to the breadth and the reach of Jupa within South Africa. And that diagram really represents the membership. Sorry, can you hear me? Our membership throughout the country. And as you can see, we have members in every part of the country. We also have satellite offices in the main region centers. And over and above that, part of our modernization reach is to equip special satellite bands. to go to government departments and members where we can actually provide information and upload forms. We'll see later as to why we do have some of the delays in paying out these benefits. So this satellite band is an attempt from our side to speed up the process of paying claims. Honourable Chairperson, if I could just summarise some of the key issues on this slide. One of the main issues I want to raise is that over the year ending 2014-15, which is 31st March 2015, we paid a total of 75,000 claims from our side. If we took the comparative figure for the year ending 2013-2014, that was 16,000. So we are finding a 25% increase in the number of claims that we've handled over the year. And that is largely due to the number of withdrawals. We are seeing large number of withdrawals of members of our of civil servants, and then we'll show you some figures just now. In terms of the actual receipts of payments, that has been steady over the years and steady in terms of quarter one. But the real issue here is that we are seeing large number of withdrawals, voluntary withdrawals from our civil servants, and I think that's something we need to interrogate. So if I go to the next slide and I say, well, what does it mean for us? Well, what it means for us, and if I could take you to the figure on the extreme right-hand side, is that at any one point we have a certain number of claims. In this case, it was 16,963 claims that we have to deal with. So if you said to us on the 4th of September, how many claims are you dealing with? I will tell you the figure is 16,963 claims. Some of those claims are sitting within JIPA and need to be paid. Of that amount is 9,906, if I could take you to the figure on the extreme right. But over and above that, there are two other areas I just want to bring your attention to, your members' attention to. Some of these claims we cannot finalize because we're waiting for information from the government departments. So that number is 4143, of which 1,900 is over 60 days. So one of the challenges we do have, and we spoke again about the satellite bands earlier, is that we need to increase our cooperation and with the government departments to make sure that these forms come in timely and the information is correct. Because if the information is not correct, then we become a little bit of a ping-pong backward and forward. But in addition to that, we're also finding that some claims cannot be finalized as a result of members, some of the issues dealing with members themselves. What we label here the third-party issues. 2,914. These are essentially claims that cannot be paid, for example, due to member not having a tax clearance. So these are issues that members themselves have to sort out. And another reason for that is that the bank account is sometimes closed. So we cannot physically pay the members, put money into the bank account because that account is closed. So the 2,914 are really in the responsibilities of the members, but you will see later that we are also taking responsibility for that by sending out messages, phone calls, and SMSs to the members, urging them to go sort out their affairs. And in terms of the employee departments, then we have plant liaison officers that actively, physically go to these government departments to try and get the correct information. If we look just below that slide there, it talks of the average days for head claimed, and you can see an extremely positive trend over the last 5 years. So the area in the blue is the time it actually takes from government departments to get us the correct information. The area in red is the time it takes us to begin processing the claims, and the area in green is the time we take to actually pay out the claim. So you can see a positive trend over the last 5 years that we are getting the claims forms from government departments quicker and quicker. So that is a very positive step. Also in terms of our modernization program, where one of our programs is called eChannel, where this information is now provided to us electronically. So we hope to actually improve on this turnaround time as well. But I think just to make the point that in order for the claims process to proceed smoothly, we do need cooperation of a large number of people, including government departments, including the members themselves, and obviously JIPA. I did allude earlier to the large number of the increase in the resignations, and we've seen a 25% increase, as I said, from 60,000 claims previous financial year to 75,000 claims. It is a cause of concern, and in this slide we talk to the number of claims we have. Honourable Chairperson, we have in our own way tried to ascertain what the reasons are for this large number of increase in the withdrawals. Initially there appeared to be some concern from members that the government wanted to nationalise their pensions. It took a lot of statements, including statements from our minister, it took some communication campaigns, etc., to get the message out that members' benefits are safe within JIPA. More recently, we've done an updated survey in terms of why we're seeing this large number of exits, and the indications are, in terms of the sample we've seen, is that some of our members are in fact indebted. So when they come across their benefit statements and they're comparing their debts to their benefit statements, they're actually seeing resignation as a possible solution to paying off their debts and then rejoining the civil servants shortly thereafter. Of course, we know that this is, they're actually shooting themselves in the foot because of the principles of compound interest. When you lose your service in your first few years, it's impossible to catch that fact. Because when you actually retire, and that's hopefully the plan for most of our members, we want to see them retiring, the end benefit depends on service period. So if you are resigning early and taking your benefits, you are losing out in the end, because the benefit at the end is also related to the salary at retirement. So unfortunately, I think this is an area we would need to refocus on in terms of improving financial literacy and in terms of holding hands with our members to actually show them the detriment that they are causing themselves by leaving the civil service and then rejoining. Chairman, one of the most exciting areas within JIPA that I've found since I joined on 1st August was the modernization program. This modernization program started in earnest about 2 years ago, and we hope to finish most of it in the next 18 months. And really it's moving from a manual process to an automated process where, for example, government departments give us their forms. 80% of those claims are now coming through electronically. So part of that, and we'll get to the next slide as well, is to improve the processes within JIPA. So it's not just electronic submission of documentation, but it's also the processing processing within JIPA. For example, when a person processes a claim and another person checks, you don't go file from one desk to another, it's done more automatically. So we hope that this process will be completed in the next 18 months, and I'll give you some indications of the successes of the modernization program and what we actually intend to achieve. So one of the first successes was the auto live verification system. Traditionally, our members would need to fill in forms to verify that they, in fact, are still living. That's a test that we do to make sure that we're not paying, we're not overpaying benefits or paying benefits when members have, in fact, deceased. We're now doing that to the Department of Home Affairs online. I did mention as well the next two. The first one is the e-channel, where we have online submission of exit documentation. We haven't reached all of our government departments in this respect. Currently, 80% of our claims are processed by our e-channel. The rest are done manually. I could speak in terms of the pilot of self-service. So hopefully in time, more of our members will be able to enjoy the service. But this is currently in a pilot phase where members can update their information and get relevant information themselves. And we've got in our call center, we've got one such program. The outreach and customer liaison officers is a critical part of what we're doing. We showed earlier that many of our claims cannot be paid because we do not receive the correct information. And in order to improve delivery, we do have these client liaison officers that liaise with the government departments. They are equipped with laptops and other equipment to allow them to perform those functions. Earlier on, we saw a picture of one of our mobile officers. That's critical because when we saw all those dots illustrating where our members are, we do have members in rural areas, we do have members in deep rural areas. Our obligation, of course, as JIPA is to service all our members. So where members are not able to utilize the satellite offices within our urban area, we have other solutions, and one of those is those mobile offices that have satellite fixtures as well. Talking more technically, as I said, the processes to process claims is being automated, and one of those is the core business process mapping, whereby the claim payment process will be automated more in future. It will be it will no longer be carrying one file from the next desk to the other. The authorization, the payments, etc., will all move from one member to the other in a more paperless environment. We do have a call center. That call center takes calls from members who have various requests, etc. And just to talk to the modernization program, one of the first aspects of it was designing the architecture. So we're almost complete with that, but over and above that are the applications. So in terms of the modernization program, as I said earlier, we're slap bang in the middle and hoping to finish most of it in the next 18 months or so. Honourable Chairperson, I think it's fair to say that an organization such as us also have our fair share of challenges, and we're not putting them on the table, and we're also showing you what we are doing about them. We've got 10 backlogs, as we saw some of our numbers. Some of them, we said, were due to members not having their affairs in order. Others are in terms of the information that's outstanding, but some of that is also within Jupa. So we are resourcing those areas that require more resources. We have a backlog committee at the moment that meets once a week. We've started this committee that looks not just at the claims, but the unclaimed benefits as well. These are benefits that are in excess of 2 years where the mode of payment is known. We appreciate that some of our members who've worked or served the civil service for many years and have subsequently left have not been paid. We are doing our absolute utmost to try and trace those members and pay those benefits out. It's critical that we do that. And in order to achieve that, we are cooperating with some of our other government departments. One of those first areas of cooperation will be with SARS, where we're trying to get information from SARS. But within government itself, there are many other entities, including workers' compensation, including the UIF, including other entities. Now, we're going to try and create databases. And this is something that we initiated in the last month or so. So we're trying to populate the telephone and the home addresses and the email addresses of these members that have not been paid by, first of all, trying to get the information from government departments. But failing which, there are other resources that might have a cost implication, but we may have to walk down that road of using, for example, tracing agents, and find that perhaps we can have a panel of tracing agents that might be able to assist us. We might be reaching to the private sector here in order to assist us. In fact, at the moment, we do have one tracing agent who is working for us, but one tracing agent would not be able to reach every corner of the country. So perhaps another option is to use a panel of tracing agents where we can pay on successful trace only. So this is an area that we're taking extremely seriously, the backlogs and the unpaid benefits, and we are addressing that. The resignations is a little more tricky, Honorable Chairperson. As we said, one of the challenges we have is that our members may be seeing their benefits as a solution to their indebtedness. So we need target education outreach programs that can assist them and make them appreciate the value of these pensions. Because, as I said, when you lose those services, because even if it's the first few years of service, you're actually losing a substantial capital value. So, as I said, we have the e-channel implemented, the simplifying of action between employer and JIPA, and we are seeing 80% of our claim forms coming through the e-channel. We do have high call volumes, possibly also related to the fact that members may be wanting to know what the values are in order to assess whether they want to resign, etc. In terms of those individuals that have bank validations that where we can't pay those benefits because of bank issues, and also in terms of tax issues, we are sending SMSs, we are sending notifications, and we are calling them. So we are taking those issues seriously as well. We want those members to be paid out, and even if it's their fault, we're taking the responsibility to urge them and encourage them to go and sort out those issues so that we can pay out those benefits. Of course, the strategy has been tabled. Some of the issues that we are focusing on in the short term, In addition to the strategy that has been tabled, the initiatives to reduce backlogs and unclaimed benefits that I spoke to, where we do have a committee that's looking at all angles in terms of paying out these benefits. We are taking stock of the operating environment. This is an incredibly dynamic environment. There's a lot happening in terms of not just pensions, but other social security issues locally, internationally. I think we need to be on top of that. If there are policy shifts as the implementer, we need to be ready for that. One of the other issues that we've initiated is the data governance and examination, where we looking at the quality of the data, security of the data is set up, that talks to the modernization and business continuity and disaster recovery, etc. But over and above that, we have now a data governance committee that will look in terms of the quality of the data we hold. And the last point in terms of a short-term focus area, of course, is to support relationship with other government entities for a number of reasons. One is we want to encourage our other organizations within government to give accurate information timely so that we can pay out these benefits. But where we need assistance in paying out these backlog claims and unclaimed benefits, we also need to engage them to try and see if they have some information that may be of assistance to us. So that, Honorable Chairperson, is our presentation in terms of the quarter one performance. And also, just to share with you some of our challenges and share with you some of the focus areas over and above the strategy that that we tabled previously. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, for inviting us.
Okay, thank you very much. Over to members. Thank you, Tandi, David, Kikiledi, and Makosi.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me take this opportunity to welcome the presentation by CIPA. And I think it's a very good presentation that they made, an eye-opener to all of us, especially ourselves as public reps. I think there are one or two things, Chair, that I want to have clarity on from the presentation. One is around the issue that GIPA has picked up, probably around pension reform issues and indebtedness of their clients, and this is what they're saying they have picked up as one of the things that causes the withdrawals. And I think coming from my other life as a counselor at some point, the administrators of creation of counselors picked up one of these challenges around issues that were confronting counselors, including the fact that there were no housing benefits and all other things. And they created a facility to assist them to deal with that. So you would access your money in a way and be able to build, but it must be done in a way that the money doesn't come to you, it goes directly to that thing so that you don't eat it and come back and want to claim. It's an example I want to say. So it was a creative way of the pension administrator to keep its client within the system. And I'm saying, looking at the challenges that public servants have, the level of indebtedness and other things, some do even this consolidation or whatever, and then be able to assist. Can't you look at mechanisms that can assist them to move out of this debt rather than them withdrawing, moving out of the system, coming back 2 years, 2-3 years later, is now or she has to be on full pension and there's nothing that she or he will survive from. That's the first thing. The second issue is around unclaimed benefits. And if you look at that, there's some level of education or advocacy program that is needed by yourself to reach out to your clients and say, as you are a government employee, make sure that annually your IRP files, your whatever, these are the things that can also disadvantage you to be able to get your full money back. Or suppose you die, your family may also have challenges on. So you sort of bring in prevention. You know, doctors will say prevention is better than cure. So you bring those mechanisms in an advocacy program that will assist them to be able to comply on certain things, so that neither them nor their beneficiaries, you know, get entangled into all these things of them at some point not being able to get their money. Imagine the amounts that are involved here. Kids and everybody not being able to go to school and whatever that, you know what most families are confronted with, especially when somebody passes on or whatever. The last issue, Chair, and I think the GPA is also free not to answer it. It's out of keen interest. The risk involved as you invest your money. I will take a popular example of the African Bank, where you also affected by some of those activities of investing your money in the African Bank, or not even limiting to it to the African Bank situation, but just looking broadly on how risky do you invest some of this money. You are free to answer or not to answer. Thank you, Chair.
No, I not answer after you've asked the question in this Parliament, but I think you've been very generous. Yeah. She's not fully recovered yet. I'm giving you a drink.
I'm saying not satisfied with Pinky. She's looking better to me, so it's better if yes, you know, when she's well, she's giving us tough time.
So let me wrap up the presentation. First, I want to start with a comment that we live in a society where we have what the president terms as challenges of unemployment, poverty, and inequality. So the challenges we have of governance, we always juxtapose them with those challenges. That if you live in a society that has high unemployment rates, poverty, and inequality, where the gap between the rich and the poor is still high, you have no option but to be facing certain challenges in all segments of development. So, based on that, what GIPA is experiencing is just but one challenge in the broader spectrum of challenges that has been. I'm saying this in the context that we have met different institutions that either deal with insurances or pensions who have had challenges in terms of, one, issues of pension reservation has been a challenge. To contain liquidity of any institution, be it in the banking sector or the pension sector, for the insurance sector has been a challenge in the context of economic challenges, not only in South Africa but in the world. So there's this picture you have, and there's this specific challenges. Then you also have a challenge where we are a consumption-driven society, basically. So when the Minister of Finance makes an analysis about the South African society, it says it's a consumption. So there's less saving in the economy. Now we'll try to locate the challenges of GIPA within the broader context. Where is the consumption-driven society, the triple challenges and so on. So your challenge does become immune for that. It's part of that world. That's my assessment of the situation. Now, I'm part of the thinking that says you need to encourage wage preservation in all facets. And one of the things I was wondering in your program, you see, when you say you are very quick to pay out, I get worried. It might look like efficiency. But you know, somebody can take an emotive decision to cash their pension, and later within 3 months change their mind, and you might have paid that pension to that individual who has taken a wrong decision. So there should be some discouragement, person. Like engaging the individuals to check whether they've come to a conclusion that they've taken the correct decision. Don't think the employer will do that. They are not the holders of the person of that individual. They're just a contributor. But you will be worried about your liquidity, so you might want to influence the client to reconsider. And a delaying payment is one but part of that tail of events that you might want to consider. When you say 35% increase of claims, to me it sounds like 1/3 of the total. So it's quite worrisome. It's a huge. If you look at the workforce, if you juxtapose the workforce to that of the unemployed people, the contributors to the revenue are very limited. So it's a huge. It's like a lot of people who want to be out of the system. It will create economic challenges in the long term, and how you've invested in your own portfolio, because it's not like there's a cash sitting somewhere waiting for those things to be processed. So the interest that you might be generating from the investment might be hampered, you know. So the financial literacy program then becomes the short-term solution to. But it's not the panacea to the challenge, because the question of indebtedness speaks to a person who might be working but responsible for the other units of indebtedness. The reality is on the ground. So the other day I made a suggestion to a particular group that have you considered, and I'm not saying, I'm just making sense, have you considered trying to make a balance between providing incentives for people to deal with the immediate indebtedness? You're not responsible for reconciliation of debt or administration there, but you might want to gain interest in trying to minimize by introducing an incentive. Let's say, for instance, for argument's sake, if there's an individual who's been in the system for 30 years, there might be a certain limited cash payment to stimulate your relationship with the client, but also address the realities on the ground that individual might. So it might be a case-by-case evaluation. I don't know how we'll come into the picture, because there will have to be some administrative relationship between the government departments and yourself in relation to that. I don't know, I'm trying to think loud here. I can't think. And also look at the pros and cons of regulation. Is it the regulation that makes it, how we structure the truth, you benefit towards the end, or, you know? I'm throwing it as a debatable matter that you consider to say. When I watch TV, I see there are insurance companies that entice people by saying, if you did not claim from us for a period of 10 years, we can give you half of benefits. I'm not saying you should copy that. You know what it would mean in this context. But something in between that tries to try and alleviate this challenge of, because the question becomes, what drives people to want to be? And of course we'll find the problem, it's in depth, it's challenges, where are the challenges? So, also the property market has not been helpful in how they conduct their business. Very expensive properties available in the market, people finding themselves. I don't even want to talk about the automobile sector, it's a different scenario altogether, just this one, which is primary. The retail market, its conduct, which particularly gets investigated by the Competition Commission all the time. So we live in a society where profit maximization is at the expense of everything. So it leads to that. And we also have generally a society that believes in conspicuous consumption. Class materialism is there, maybe it's because of so many years of oppression, everybody feels free and they experiment with, you know, having access to cash and stuff like that. It's possible. So it feeds to the cycle, social behavior of individuals in their conduct generally, and how we can remedy that through systems and not just be rigid in the application of the law. So let me ask this question to try and wrap up chat before you call me to order. One is, have you considered the delay in the payments and how has this affected your liquidity? And have you considered trying to minimize the claims but also dealing with this claim? It might not necessarily want answers now. It might be an issue that you might want to consider. Because sooner or later we need to put regulations to try and curb, because it will be nice if people claim because we get more tax in return from government, but it's not going to help us in the long term. They're going to be back into the cycle as now the scales of old age grants, when actually it could have been encouraged to save in a way. So maybe we might even encourage that in the salary system, we increase the percentage of money that goes to pensions so that it can be a benefit at a later stage. We restructure the salary system to accommodate it. So I don't know. I've got two other things in my mind, Jack. They might not be helpful. I don't know. But let me pause there.
It's 11:01. We've got up to 13:00. So you're free to speak as much as you want.
Yeah.
But then we have like Friday's meeting where there's seven committees. Then obviously the three chairs are going to say up to 10 minutes. So you don't have to apologize. You can speak for as long as you want. There are times I ever, and I'm not speaking to you, Comrade Tandy, but everybody, where chair after chair. And you don't like it, you go to the chief board, All I'm saying to you is there's no one apologize. I'm telling you. Right? You can carry on speaking because we've got two more hours. You can take another 10 minutes for
The last comment is that there's a generic assumption that people understand issues of the economy and finances and so on, and even those who are deemed to be literate in other disciplines. And it's not given. It's not a given for a phenomenon. That you might have this degree in whatever social science, and so on. But when it comes to rents and rents and how you are supporting the future and so on, it's practical and it's possible, because in some societies it was more about bread and butter issues, they immediate ones. And you know, issues of investment and long term, you know, were not necessarily. And I think this is the repercussion of that. It relates to that. So it manifests itself in this manner, and we have to deal with it. So the outreach program is one part of investment to try and take people through this process, and communication, more communication to alleviate the fear, even with this allegation that government ought to nationalize pension fund. You know, people believe in what is reported in the media and in the public space. So what is in the public discourse can lead to panic and people moving either way to try and protect what they believe, especially when they look at what happens in other countries and so on. They think it's possible that it can happen to
them. David, you're confident that sort of policy, so you don't allow that latitude here.
I know, I'm sorry, I apologize. It's a problem, you got me those things.
Thank you very much. Let me also join the members also before me to welcome the presentation. As Chair, as expected, we're all concerned about the withdrawal. But then one asks about, when you speak about the 45 days that you are able to process, are we talking about the 45 days on the withdrawal or on a pension where somebody has reached a certain age where it's supposed to be on pension? Because previously we know there have been delays, you know, people have been complaining. But if the 45 days is a norm on everything that you're processing, it's really appreciated. I think we live to see that. I'll go back to the high withdrawal and agreeing with the reasons that you have given, the same assessment that one is experiencing in our constituency, because we know at some stage this thing has also brought some debate and, you know, quarrels and disagreements among the parties in parliament, whereby other parties were blaming the government, were blaming some ministers, were blaming some, you know, the ruling party, that all these things are happening because that's true. And you can imagine if a political party here in parliament believe what media was portraying, what will happen to ordinary people. Hence we have experienced the withdrawal in mass. Chair, my biggest issue here is what has been raised by other members. What are we doing about this? I know that has been, you know, the Minister of Finance has gone out there talking to people to say that is not true, that is not going to happen. But I've also asked myself, how much time or effort has it taken to involve other stakeholders? Because I want to believe, with the experience I have in my previous life, that once this has happened and you involve labor, they can assist you. But also believe in that. Maybe you need to up your game in terms of your strategy, your communication strategy, do roadshows, speak to people, and also popularizing those satellite offices that you're having. How many, you know, people or that everybody within the area know that there is such an office, and how is this office going to help? Not everybody have an access to internet, have an access to TV or newspaper, but look at the name of communications that can access or reach people, your targets that are disadvantaged. Not everybody who's working in government understands the system. But then the more you go out, the more you engage those people, the more you talk to them, you even use the community radio station, you know, be local, be at the level, so that they understand what is going on. But also, I want to propose, Chair, in that process, that, Honorable Claudia was talking about the engagement, the one-on-one. You know, in an employment situation where an employee is resigning, there will be an exit interview to understand. I know that some are just doing it for the sake of doing it. What are you going to do with that information that you're getting? The reason why people are exiting is another thing. But I want to agree with the Honorable Tobias to say, let's have one-on-one to show the disadvantage of people moving out of the system. That what we are doing is not really helping them. We are also trying our best, but the roadshow, I think, is going to help more.
You spoke of a close relationship with other government entities and stakeholders. As in my previous statement, I said, maybe you should also draw in labor so that they can also talk to their members, explain to assist you in this program that you're having. I think that will assist a lot. Chair, I want to raise something which maybe might be a problem to me alone. When we come to meetings, we expect to engage with documents. And a disadvantage is when you receive a document in a meeting. That becomes a disadvantage. So we appreciate that we receive this document time so that we can go through them, scrutinize them, and have an understanding. So that when we engage, we know what we're engaging on. We don't use our common sense. We engage on what you have presented and we're able to see it beforehand. Chair, I think in our future meeting, where we are going to also discuss or evaluate the performance of FIPA, we'll have to talk to the issues, the remaining actions that we have identified here, which are the rules. So we'll see in future when we meet with you how far you have gone, is it working or not. So I want to also appreciate that you have identified challenges but also recommended remedial actions. That will assist in making sure that there will be the problem. Thank you very much.
I assume, given the fact that the Government Pension Administration Act is responsible for the administration of pensions, this is not the opportunity to ask detailed questions about the investments made by certain pension funds. We have an opportunity to do that later in the year. So my question relates to the whole question of the voluntary withdrawals, which you correctly raised as a serious problem. I wonder if you could tell us if you could provide us, I beg your pardon, with the actual numbers for each month in the first quarter of 2015. I know they're in the graph, but they're just slightly unclear. The second, I wonder if you could provide us with, or tell us whether there are any particular explanations for the peak in withdrawals, particularly in February 2015 and May 2015. And then, finally, whether in your survey concerning the reasons for withdrawals, any of the respondents informed you that one of the reasons they may have considered withdrawal was the perception that the pension funds, particularly the government employees' pension fund, is investing or invests in risky assets and has an investment strategy driven by political considerations rather than investment considerations. Because my hypothesis is that the peaks could be explained by a public perception, whether it's valid or not, that the government employee pension fund is in fact bailing out risky state-owned enterprises like Eskom.
Low quality and long. Go for it. I'm allowing you 25 minutes to reply.
No, Chair, you see, he still needs to grow intellectual. I will forgive him. Both his experience and his intellectual capability.
She wants
no, I'm not tweeting. I'm being straight, gentlemen, because you have acknowledged before, and before both that you had acknowledged. And I don't want you to feel like it's my community. I like it so much. It's my home.
Mr. Chairman, I note that I'm the homeboy and you are not. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I note you use the words getting old. But anyway, let's move on, Mr. Chairman. The Thank you very much for the presentation. I just want to home in a little bit on the Compensation Commission. It's an area that I've had some practical experience over the years, and right now I've got a couple of claims that have been going on for years, and we had the Compensation Commission with us a little while ago, and I was quite chuffed in a way that they didn't blame you when I raised the issue. You talk about 45 days, and that's a huge improvement. But as far off, and one particular claim I'm dealing with, which is like 4 years old, and I write letters, and I seem to go into a black hole. But I'm writing to the Compensation Commission, not to you guys. And so I'm curious about your relationship there, more than, and not really about the specifics of what I'm saying. That's not what I'm here for. So that would be of interest to me. Then the other one is what progress you're making with SARS, for instance, because SARS has huge privacy obligations to adhere to, and I'd be curious as to whether they're going to be letting you have information or not, and how that would fit in with their mandate. And then, Mr. Chairman, the last one, which I think all of us on the committee are of one mind on, is the question of withdrawals. And I think that many good ideas have come out this morning, but I think that perhaps what I need some clarity on is the same comes to you after the resignation has already taken place. Is that right? You're nodding head, so that's a quick answer for that one. So, you know, I'm not sure where the emphasis should be on trying to stem this. Certainly you could play a role, but perhaps we need to go back one step to the organizations that they're resigning from. Thank you, Mr. Chin.
Thank you very much, Chair. Professor Paul, let me thank you for the presentation. And I do want to say that you are one of the administrators that I respect in the industry because of the way you administer. I mean, it's been the reforms that have taken place in GEPF over the last few years, and obviously GEPF being the largest, one of the largest bars in the world, it's not just a big bar in Africa, but in the world. So it's actually quite enormous, and one wants to appreciate that. One of the things that I need to find out from you though is that how much is your administration fee and what is the cost of the administration fee to the beneficiary, to the contributor. Okay. And the other thing that I also wanted you to know is in respect of and of course some of the obvious questions may be police questions, but one would really want to hear you out on this particular one. You know, you are also administering the military pensions in terms of the military pensions access, right? Yeah. Now, I just want to know how many, there are those that were former MKs, that were became military veterans. Are they incorporated here? What is the benefit scheme? How different is the benefit scheme of those old ones who are SADF, you like, and the newly, the ones that were integrated? the other thing that I also wanted you to know is, given the fact that GEPF, which you are administering, is a defined benefit scheme, we've seen how, and believe me, I am actually for the defined benefit scheme, but the trend has been to move towards the DC. And I want to know in terms of your future viability, financial viability of the fund, will it
Of course, given its sheer size, I know that it's kind of living pretty well. But I am worried because of the withdrawals that you are talking about and how they may be impacting on the fund going forward, because sometimes you see a problem being small and it then becomes much bigger. Before you know it, it becomes much bigger. And believe you me, don't worry, as much as I hear, and we will have to still answer Honorable David's question, but I think your answer that you gave earlier on about the reasons for this voluntary withdrawal, you attributing that to entire indebtedness, I think I can concur with you. Because we do have a problem, and Honorable Tobias did point that out. We do have a serious value system problem in this country. We have post-materialism, and I think, you know, it comes with this whole thing of seeing the other neighbor is doing this, now you also want to do it. It's a much bigger problem which needs to be addressed, not just by yourself, but all of us, even us politicians, we have a role to play in actually changing the value system in the country. But the point I wanted to hear from you is that, looking at being a defined benefit scheme, how are you mitigating? Are you going to be mitigating against this risk? Now, I'm looking at this thing of voluntary withdrawal as a risk factor to the fund, and not just as something that is, you know, that is just a random occurrence, but I'm just linking it to the risk. Chair, the thing is, there is something that I have to say here, which I think probably is policy, and I'm hoping that my DA colleagues are listening, because it's something that we might all, as members of parliament, have to look at. We have our own fund, the public officer's fund, administered by private companies. And then when we make decisions, people, they can see that we are playing double standards, because you are not, your fund, you know, when you are saying we are going to be, you know, when they hear PIC is investing the money here and there, it's not our money, because our money is sitting somewhere else. And I think it is a policy issue that will have to be addressed by us, because I really do think that it is totally unfair that we have an agency that is doing a very good job. I mean, unless we see a disappointment tomorrow, but so far I'm feeling very good about you guys. But, you know, we have a very good, very, very good administrator. We have a very, very, we have a very good capacity there. And I don't understand why are we not hearing that even our own fund being administered there. But the question of the administration, it becomes important. How competitive are you compared to other administrators out there? And the other thing I also wanted to say here, there is a very, very thorny issue which we will have to confront. We have the government employees pension fund, but for some strange reason, we are defining local government out. And I'm going to tell you about, because I was involved during the process of transferring, when GEPF transferred those former Act 293 funds they had problems, endless problems. Now suddenly they were administered by you, now somebody else is administering them, and there was no due process in looking at whether the administrator or the fund that you are transferring those employees to, whether they do adhere to the same standard as you, or whether they do actually follow the legislation, whether they have the systems in place and all that, and as a result, a lot of them lost out. And again, I think this is becoming a problem, and probably this is something that maybe you need to start engaging with National Treasury on. In local government, the reason why we have high packages, it's because we have moved with this conversion of total cost to employer. That is why you have other municipal managers that are paid 4 million. You understand the annum. Because you've moved with that, and they are saying, of course, I'm no longer in a DB, you know, and I'm not secure here. And as a result, you have those problems with municipalities. I want to hear from you. If they there any process that you are involved with in terms of engaging with the local government sector where they can, as much you have referenced other funds, and I think you can have probably a local government pension fund, a ring fence there. Because that fund, I am telling you, it's when I was the CEO of SALGA, it was worth 298 billion. And there are 79 funds. No, but I am telling you, I'm not declaring. We at the time, we had 79 funds. And now I'm sure we have more because subsequently somewhere has also established its own fund and so forth. Now, if you look at the numbers, in local government, the employees, there are not more than 300,000, all of them in total. But you have over 79 funds. I am worried about the administration costs. I'm worried about the fund managers, your trustees, your asset manager, and what have you. I mean, the list is endless. And your principal officers, they have to be remunerated or whatever. It doesn't make sense. I know that before you thought it was when you, because you know, you were part, I'm going to treat you as if you were part of, you know, something that is almost like this kind of something where you were dumping these people, the former Abdullahi three people. I'm saying, are we not reconsidering that so that we have a much bigger fund? But to reinvent it, of course, because the conditions of employment at local government level are different from national and provincial government, and that you have a specific fund for that. If you could answer me in that, I would really, really appreciate, because these are some of the issues that are concerned me. And finally, can you also comment on how you are dealing with fraud and corruption? I know that you have your internal audit unit, and given the fact that you are administering such a huge fund, chances of you being, as being, having fraud happening in your as the administrator now, because the administrator is... The GEPF is just the you are the key when it comes to viability, how the fund is managed and what have you. So I need to know what are the issues in terms of the fraud and corruption, because you are going to be prone to that. And the final, I thought I was going to be final. No, and the last thing that I wanted to say is that maybe if you could tell us about your investment strategy. How do you select? Of course, I know that the large chunk of your money goes to PIC, which does all the investment for you. But maybe if you can elaborate better on how it works, so that as the members we know what you when we are holding you accountable on behalf. Of course, you have your own board of trustees that are holding you accountable on a daily basis, but we also have to play our oversight role. We have to get this kind of information for us to be able to answer, to be able to see whether you are doing well or not. But you are actually, to me, given the size and the difference and the kinds of funds that are administering, I think you are doing a fantastic job. And there is nothing political about people withdrawing the money. I think Honorable Dave must just be happy. We have a problem of high indebtedness in South Africa, and I think that's it. There is no political decision here, because we are not involved in how you decide where to invest and so forth. Even with the EIC, the case is very independent, by the way. They are the ones that decide. They look at it. They have their own risk team and what have you and what have you. So Honorable David, unfortunately, thinks that there is always a third force. And in this case, it's us now, the ANC, that is the third force. Thank you.
Now, when there's no pressure on people, acting like, you know, the chair is breathing down their neck. Now, Bridget, you don't know, I'm a very devious kind of people chair. What I'm going to do on Friday when we have a lot of members and tell them, hey, by the way, the 10 minutes are up, right? The people will tell me, oh, you see, I'm in a role now. I just want to make my main point, you put me out, right? And so on and so on. Sorry?
I'm
collecting
my 10 minutes on Friday.
Okay, with Frank Jenkins, can we get some real advice on that one? Okay, on a serious note, I really think, frankly, that the questions that I was going to ask are actually us in a much more eloquent and incisive way than others. Actually, what I'm saying, is pretty banal. But I just want to say that because I've got nothing original to say. It covered me. Actually, if you look at the points here in bold, right? Apart from slide 7, everything else is covered, right? So everything actually is covered in a better way than I would have covered it. So I'm going to be very brief. What I want to pick up on is just emphasize, I'm not saying anything new, emphasize what other people have. The first thing is, I'm very much on Pinky's page, if you like, and others here, who are basically, it's the same sort of courage we as you spoke. Is there nothing you can do to preempt this withdrawals, right? Resignations, right? And can't you, you know, we've been, by the way, Comrade Dave and I were sitting with an AP, who was asking similar things about pension fund. It's got huge debts, right? And this is an MP with an MP salary. Think of a teacher and an average civil servant, right? I'm not even PhDs and someone who will get paid quite well, traditionally. So in short, he was asking whether it's not possible after you're 55 and so on, or whether age issue wouldn't arise when it comes to your business. And if Makosi's point and Tandy's point, which I agree with largely, not only, is that there's the impetus. And by the way, I've raised this before. In China and in India, there are similar things happening. A quick upward mobility of an emerging middle class, which has been deprived for whatever reason. In this case, racism, colonialism, apartheid. In the case of China, David will argue, the communist command economy, etc. In the case of India, David will argue the restraints on India's social democracy, and then one of the things comes in and liberates the market. But I don't agree with that, neither here nor there. It is a common thing. I feel in these three countries. I've been to them, I'm parliamentary, and I serve in other political capacities, so that's and the Chinese Communist Party I've met many times in a different capacity. Actually, it opens. I spent 2 weeks with them 3 years ago. The main theme there was we don't know what to do with our young people. And you're the guy that takes it around. His preoccupations are, can you get a job in South Africa? What's the cost of an employee's cell phone? And this is the sort of answers I would give him. You know? I mean, I've forgotten about socialism and Maoism. I've studied for many years. When I was a student activist, who wasn't, my era, I don't know who was here, who wasn't thrilled and with this romantic long march and the idea that we'll break down the gap between intellectual and manual labor, as if I can go and hoe in the countryside and so on. But in the 70s, I was ready to do those things. Now, I'm a bit more cautious. And now I've also disabused myself about the long march actually meant and the Cultural Revolution. But in short, I must tell you, I have seen pieces by sociologists, you know, the more, like the Johnny Steiner types, you know, who write about things along this line. It's a more common thing. I suspect in Brazil, too, you know. I suspect Indonesia, too. So there's a broader, it's been discussed exhaustively by the members. They're brilliant, I thought. I'm the sociologist, so to speak. But Makosi and Tandy were going on and on the other day, and I actually felt that you could lecture in sociology, right? They were really, really very good. So we're not going to cover those themes. But in short, as Pinky says and others do, is there nothing you can do? This AP said to us, Dave and me, at lunch, can't we allow us to extract a bit of our money? We pay some tax, but we need to deal with our debt. Now, this is an MP that you have a committee, right? With the salaries we have. Now, so what can you do? Is there anything you can do? Without undermining the prospect that when you retire ultimately, you do have enough to survive. So you'll find a balance between withdrawing money in a phased, orderly, manageable way without undermining the goal that you must be able to live at the end. The second thing is, I think we have discussed these things, comrade and colleagues, too much. We need now action. This thing about unpaying benefits is just horrendous, right? Mm-hmm. And what we have to do now, what I'm suggesting, Peter Paul, is we find a slot where we hold all the relevant actors together. This theme has been discussed too much. I think we now, we have been extremely incisive in my view as a committee, not me as a chair, but the members there, about what can be done, what should be done, what the problems are, and so on. We need to understand why these things happen first, before we decide what course of action we take. And I think the elements of insight, I wish that the minutes we take in these meetings were more accurately. I'm going to tell you, I looked at PMG minutes, by the way, Mr. Leith, following your request. And those minutes, and the minutes we do also. I don't think they capture the quality of what people say. And I'm not blaming anybody before, because I think the experience of members here and the experience of yourself and other people is different, right? So what I'm saying in short is, I just don't think we must have it on top. We must actually get some action going on unclear benefits. So I want members to think about this. Either next quarter, maybe it's ambitious, or certainly maybe the first quarter next year, the committee week, We bring financial stability, board, yourselves, actors in civil society who are relevant, and we have a proper workshop, and we take decisions. Then we take the report to Parliament, and we call on all of you to come every quarter and tell us what you all are doing. If there is no integrated structure that brings all of you together to deal with this unclaimed benefit thing, then we get a huge debate in the House. Then we have the provincial legislatures and tell to say, so bring in Connie Sita Paul, now that she's here, and Alan is not here, Letta will know these things because she is here as it happens, exiting today, but until 1 o'clock she's with us. And he prays it too much on her not to finish her job at 1. Otherwise, we'll have to withdraw everything on Friday. So we're very vulnerable there. Itself also help us, right? I think what we do is, members, can you forward, and harass the members because, you know, they don't listen to me, maybe they listen to you before. Give some names to Peter Paul and Alan. By next week, let's draw a list of who we're going to invite. On this unclaimed benefit, let's make it a big concern.
Yeah.
Right? Let's get the minister to speak in a debate, right? And then let's see if we can infuse it into the cabinet so that the president comes out, you know, in his budget vote debate or something next year and says and appeals to people, right? And so on, so that we actually make this a campaign. And I think, you know, if there's a risk, Richard, if you can pull all the threads, you know, unfortunately, because you've got a million other things to do. Pull the threads together. I was so impressed with what the members said here the last time we discussed this pension issue. Okay? That I think, look at the minutes there, pull all that stuff together about why this committee feels as a whole, everybody contributed, including the opposition for once, that even I was here at least. Let's put all of that together and give you some insight into where we are. And maybe, Bridget, you, what you could do on behalf of the committee, when we have that hearing or the sitting, we actually say this is what the committee has said over the last, I think. We started talking about this very early in the beginning of this time. So we think this, so we're not covering the same ground. So on the thing of unclaimed benefits, what I want members to think about and I want you to respond is between now, getting in mind the local government elections and the end of calendar year 2016, we must have achieved progress. We must have brought it down. That means the party that should be the provincial chairs of the finance and scorecard committees, let's think of who. Let's move on to things. Felda, I'll speak to Manuri myself and George, and of course he will, and you know, we will persuade him to come. We tried the NCOP committee in. We called the minister in maybe to say some introductory remarks or the deputy minister. And it was sitting for like 9 to about 3. And this was a Friday, given us pending for this time. You know, Wednesday is better because Parliament sits up until about Thursday begins at 3. So on that issue, that's what I want to propose, right? You could tell us how much you work with, a bit more about how much you work with other institutes, the relevant institutions and agencies. What you think we could do as a committee to advance this cause of yours, unclaimed benefits, right? And our general cause. Do you have organizations, names of experts in universities and so on, who think they're working in this area, give it to us now or in a week. So that's on the issue of unclaimed benefits. On the issue of withdrawals, I really don't think, look, David, you need to come to your own conclusions. But I'll be interested to know how you arrive at a view that the reason people are withdrawing their money out their pensions is because they are concerned, since you mentioned what you're saying, that the money that they have is being abused by this government in respect of allocating state-owned entities and so on. That's a wild one. Maybe you want to come back on that. I want to know, in a moment. You can come back and explain why you think that's the case. I find that as against all the structural, political, cultural, historical, financial, economic and other issues that other members have raised, to the extent it carried any weight, I would imagine, this is my sense, I don't have any evidence before me, I would imagine that it's a very minor consideration of a certain strata, probably outside the ANC's voting base, mainly. Right?
Yeah.
Right? It's also people who are disgruntled with the government's performance and where it is going and the majority party. They're the same people who probably are reluctant to pay their taxes and so on, right? So, in other words, the over-indebtedness that consumes this country, excuse the pun, and against, newly, upwardly mobile people, It's got nothing to do with race and so on. You can look across the divide, Indians, Chinese, South Africans, Brazilians probably, like all these emerging, I'm sure in Indonesia, I saw a piece by a novelist actually, and we have a book, the theme is around the same thing. This upwardly elite communities that have just emerged, they're not that, you see, if you look at the aristocracy, if you look at Europe and how the bourgeois emerged, right, it was an organic, orderly growth over like generations, okay? Your great-great-great-grandfather had a little shop, and then they fought the feudal forces against them, and so on. It's basic sociology, 101, Marxism, 101. Even if you don't like Karl Marx, you have to take into account the value of what he says in some or other respect of what he says, right? Otherwise, one third of the world would not have become a Marxist, right? And no matter how those regimes eased away from the tenets of Marxism, the truth is, after the Bible, the most powerful Muslims might say otherwise, but the most powerful force has been Marxism. All its cultures. So in short, what I'm saying is, the thing is, you can say, I've been somebody here, how many minutes did the poor rescue me from them? I'm saying to you, you see, there are broad issues here, which is, No, it's an understanding of structure and society, rather than reducing this to culture and biology, which is, I'm not saying you're implying, but you're teaching on the surface of that. I'm saying to you in short, I think, and maybe you should apply your mind, you're the expert, that you see where you have people who don't like organically grow over like generations, through the Industrial Revolution, so, where it happens quickly, whether you're from China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Indonesia, they're common things. New upward police, who are, haven't acquired the, let's say, technical ability. This is a difficult thing. I can't do it myself. I can tell you my own experience. Yeah. I was learning something at the university, senior lecture in sociology. I come here to this university. I mean, to this Harvard, sorry. And I'm trying to find my salary is going up. No, I'm saying to you, I won't give any credit for my host, right? She's her own person. So I won't be a typical politician. So, in short, now I'm saying to you, there are bigger issues here than what David is suggesting. I'm replying to David May in particular, in a sort of amorphous, broad way, because I don't address him. I think there may be an element of that, but it's too broad at this point. I think what Makosi says is correct and sound. And particularly, it's the broader things that they've discussed before and in a truncated form in today's meeting. They were much better, I think, in the broader socio-economic, cultural, historical, blah, 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 background for the problems we're having. So in short, I really think on this of withdrawals, we have to talk about over-indebtedness, and I don't know how we take this forward, because it involves trade and industry, it involves many other committees, but I want members to apply their mind before we end the 30-00, beyond talking the way we have, and we've done a lot, what can we do? The minister went up there and did a statement. It was broadly covered in the media. You yourself have been exchanged with this and he said, as you've discovered, that there's less to do, if I'm correct, what you said to me and to Des and I, is there's less to do with concerns about the nationalization, so to speak, of your pensions, than to do with over-indebtedness. Right? And you had some figures, you told me then. Am I correct in understanding? Maybe you'll qualify what you're saying, right? It's better to answer, maybe I'll answer you wrongly. So on this issue of withdrawals, resignations, any members think what we can do beyond just talking about it and writing a report. And the next thing I want to ask is a particular one. When people resign, right, say as a teacher, and then take their money, then what happens, like a week or two passes and they apply for the same job and they get reappointed? It's so easy to leave your job and then come back. In other words, you can literally resign. You can resign 48 hours and then come back to the same job. What is the principle? Retain the job because he or she is sympathetic to your need for money and therefore resignation, right? Thirdly, I want to ask you, are there not like these entrepreneurs in the industry who are actively misinforming people and putting it to them that, look, you've got a huge debt, pay it, right? And this is how you can pay it. You see anything one can do about that? I mean, you know, can't one reach the industry and say to them, look, there must be some professional ethical conduct, right? Given the Twin Peaks legislation and we're overhauling all the, I see the, by the way, comrades, colleagues, you see the business day, I can see the pension sitting you had last week. It's really, you saw Monday's newspapers, just mm-hmm. these yesterday's kind of articles, they're saying things like the insurance industry is worried about pensions, commissions being cut, and the effect, needlessly, always, they said, will be on the
yeah.
consumer. Have you seen that sort of stuff? I think our meeting, which I wasn't present at, actually had the ripples. So, the next thing I want to ask you related to that is, what choice does a person have? You can say it's an emotive decision, right? But once you've consumed and you can't pay, and the only option you have to rescue a house or whatever, or pay off an early debt or to finish it, or whatever it is, a car thing, what other choice have you got? I mean, you either take that pension, you know, for us to sit here, and we must be judgmental also, without on our end patronizing people, we've got to serve interest. People smoke and say, okay, it's your choice to smoke. No, we've got to alert them to the consequences of it, you know, perhaps another reason. So, you know, explain a bit more about some of how these things happen, so that men can, well, at least me, I can get a better understanding of what we can do to preempt this, right? Then, be quickly on other issues. Slide 15, slide 7 I didn't understand, right? I think you said something, but I don't follow you, Mr. Chair. Slide 7, there's a gap, it's not a gap between the figures here on 5 and 7, right? So you get 57 billion annual revenue, and then 81 billion is really in benefits. But that's benefit, you're dealing with a quarter, is that, that's the reason.
Yeah.
All right, okay, I understand you. The other thing that we need to talk about a bit, because experience at my constituency, oh man, it's been on for 7 years. In our culture, as you know, people are multiple partners. Now, the thing we often have, and I've got a similar case right now, what I'm dealing with in my constituency, right? There's no clarity about who qualifies and doesn't. And I had a case before you that a chief referred to me, like an Eastern Cape woman will recall. Your predecessor will recall as well. Now, the thing is that, should we not, are we doing enough to educate the beneficiaries about the need to be clear about who their partners are, in whatever form they have the partnership and the knowledge, right? It's not for us to judge. It's for people to choose to do what they want to do, and, you know, this is what various beneficiaries do, and we have to address that. We can't see what often happens is the partners lose out. I've had this case about at least 10, 12 times over the last 21 years where it's so difficult, not least in the parliamentary arena where we have staff or constituency administrators who pass on. And then you've got many partners and it's never settled and one dragged on for 7 years, I want to tell you, into courts and so on. So can something be done about that? I'll leave the rest of it because I think there's too many questions asked. I think you can pick up on the main themes and then answer some of the concrete questions. David, you want to say something?
Yeah.
My question isn't coming here. Where's your evidence for what you
said? Chair, I don't think that, well, let me, I don't think I need to defend my question, I just need an answer to it, but let me motivate how it arises. You will recall during the assets sale of Vodacom shares to the pension fund, there was a perception, whether that perception is valid or not, and the evidence for that perception was outcry on the radio and in the newspapers. That the pension fund was bailing out Eskom and investing in risky assets. And my hypothesis is that that led to a lack of confidence and trust in the pension fund. I think it's an hypothesis, and I ask the question because here we have a survey done which will give us some reliable knowledge about whether this perception was valid and whether it had any effect on withdrawals. That is not for a minute to question the overall point that was made, and that was that high levels of indebtedness are a huge problem and probably the main factor
part of the explanation. You want to know if you're somebody that has to pay for this. Although, of course, the vote of sale came very recently. And this is a problem that had a surge, I think, last year in the public domain, right? On the eve of the beginning of this financial year. So to the extent it's an issue, a very recent issue. Right. Okay, fine. So pay for this.
Mr. Bacher, just a small thing. Everything well done. That was the better way of phrasing that question. Yeah, I always started putting politics and remote on views. no, Chair. No, I thought it's going to be absolutely important for us to get the class profile. Now that you were talking about masses,
I suddenly emerged to me, not that I am one, I'm not. The thing is, you know, we need to understand the class profile of these unclaimed benefits. Because my experience was that the people that are not claiming these benefits, and this is my assumption, probably it's my hypothesis as well, is that it's largely the people that need it most. In other words, the ones only in the lowest strata of the hierarchy. So I think it's going to be important, and this can also give us a figure. What if we're talking about unclaimed benefits given the enormity of these funds? Maybe you can break it down according to the different funds that you have, depending whether we have the discussion with you to tell us what amount are we talking about here. Thank you. Because you are actually big. So we are more we want to get, at least when we get some figures from you, it's actually going to be able to assist us to ascertain the enormity of the problem. Obviously, you being a government, largely government, you know, the other funds that are privately, because that's where a lot of money is sitting actually. It's these privately administered funds, and that can give us a sense to, you know, at least have a rough figure about what are we talking about here.
You know, I agree with Makosi, because I've discussed this myself independently of her. This thing about if you say, invest all these public sector engines into infrastructure, right? That's a big call, remember, COSATU and SACP in the first instance, about 10 years ago, right? And yet, we as MPs, as pointed out them, of course, you'll be interested to know, in alliance structures, that it's fine for us sitting here as ministers, deputy ministers, MPs, and so on, saying, our pension funds are not affected, so we should put our money where our mouth is. Right? It's not fair. I think, of course, you're absolutely right. And that issue is going to explode as government begins to feel the pressure, to put pressure on the pension funds, to invest in infrastructure and so on, right? So, in short, I just want to echo what Makosi said.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, honourable members, for the discussion and all the points raised. Honourable Chairman, with your permission, I will ask members of the Tripa team just to assist with some of the answers. I've made as detailed notes as I can, so I hope to cover all of the points raised. I will just go to some of my colleagues first, just to raise specific issues, and also just to note the comments made in terms of the timing of documentation. Thank you for bringing that attention, and I've noted that. Thank you for bringing that. If I could just perhaps start with my colleague Hesti, the head of legal services, just to comment on the issue of multiple spouses and in terms of the updating of the beneficiaries of processes, etc. And then our other colleagues will come down, and I hope in terms of my notes we can cover all of the points raised. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Chair, as I think it has been indicated, JIPA administers the GBF benefits specifically in terms of the government employees pension law and its rules. And in fact, the GEP law rules do provide for multiple spouses. It provides for the recognition of multiple spouses, and it also provides for the recognition of what we refer to as a life partner as a spouse. However, the benefit in this of what is then produced as a spouse benefit remains the benefit of whatever it would have been calculated as, meaning that whether there's one spouse being recognized or whether there's three spouses being recognized, being it in terms of civil rights or customary law, the same fixed benefit is then divided between the number of spouses being recognized. Similarly, so there's a process where a life partner can be recognized as the life partner of a member. Such a life partner that is so recognized, also including same-sex partners, are then treated as a spouse of such a member. But the primary line to such a spouse's benefit will always be the spouse which is recognized in terms of civil or customary rights, as opposed to a life partner. I think, again, like I've indicated, the important thing to understand is that whether if there are two or three or more partners being recognized as spouses, the benefit is not paid threefold or fourfold. The benefit remains the same, then equally divided between the number of spouses recognized. In order to recognize a life partner, there's a procedure that needs to be followed, where the two parties need to indicate that they do live as what would normally be a partner of the like a husband and wife partner, or where they would be dependent on each other. And then the equal benefit as a spouse benefit, and the same as the equal benefits to what a spouse would have received, is then applicable to such a life partner. It's also possible to recognize such life partners prior to passing away of a member. But as like with divorce, and this is not necessarily a formal divorce that takes place with life partners, unfortunately the process needs to be confirmed again at time of death in order to ensure that that life partner still remains the life partner of such a member as you would go through the process with a spouse, as I said, in terms of civil or customary law claim process.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I just wanted to check. Not that I am against what you are saying, I understand the procedure. But can a woman nominate to have more than one partner? Because what I see here is an unfair system where women are subsidizing these men. I'm asking this honestly because I think we are all the time this thing keeps on coming up and we don't address it because there is another point. I mean, I'm a single woman. I chose that to be a single woman. But if my money is going to be, because there has to be some kind of subsidization somewhere. If the other one is going to have 600-700 tribes or whatever, and you know, I'm just with me, with my kids, can a woman nominate another? Can I nominate another, you know?
It's just a brutal need.
No, it's a fair question. Can I say related to that, right? You see, you're giving me the root. I'm familiar with most of it, but it's not everything you say. My issue was something which I didn't put sharply enough, which you see in all the cases I've dealt with since 1994. It's women, in this case, the partners, who are excluded from any recognition, right? But they've actually got children. Who are the losers out there? If you don't have children, it's tough to prove it, right? Because you're going to paternity tests and so on, right? The thing that I'm asking is, you know, it's because and it's sensitive, and it's got cultural nuances and so on. But I want to ask you, is there something you do that alerts, and it's invariably men, right? Invariably men. All my cases, it's men. And in all my cases, it's women that are lost out, right?
Yeah.
Right? And I have appealed to the ANC as well, and they say, what do we do? The rules are set by the pension fund. I went to them. Yeah. To the previous chief, well, just here. And he pointed out, what can I do? You are absolutely right. I said, but these are our companies doing this. Point I'm trying to make is there something you can do to alert the invariably male members that if they have multi-power partners, they have to be mentioned and they have to recognize that this pension fund does allow, on their passing away, their partners, however many they are, a share of the benefits.
Yeah, but sir, that's not what Makosi is raising. Makosi is saying that in society,
yeah,
we have a situation where customer laws actually benefit men, and the cross subsidization comes in the context of taxation, where actually the benefit in a context go to the other.
I understand perfectly what you're saying.
Or
a different question.
Like you.
Yeah. No, you're right. But I'm saying there's another aspect of victimization of women. That's one aspect. The other aspect is, in all the cases, including the one I currently have. In the one I currently have, it's two women. Right? And I'm battling, right? So, you know, what I'm saying is that, in short, it's women that lose out both ways. My course is way and a way that I've experienced over the last 21 years.
All right, thank you. I think just on that point, again, and it seems like when you say we recognize multiple partners, I think this is an important point to understand, is that the benefit that such a partner would be entitled to remains a fixed benefit. So if there's just a single beneficiary, a single partner recognized, or if there's four partners recognized, the benefit is not being paid four times that benefit because someone has got four recognized partners. If the benefit was 100 rand, it remains 100 rand, and where there's four partners, they each can get only 25 rand. So, so stick to the one recognized partner. So to allay the fear a little bit, the benefit is no not that they get 400 and the single partner gets 100. I think obviously with regards to alerting male members of other that they're partnered and I think ultimately both sides, and I think it's your point that it's beneficiaries who suffer in the instances, and a lot of time it's children who suffer. As time goes on, and I think as members also become more involved in these matters, some of the areas where we as an administrator now do get to know about beneficiaries that's not necessarily known to us initially is with things like maintenance matters. And maintenance matters and various maintenance orders and maintenance inquiries against the pension fund currently, which we also have an increase on, is alerting us to that there are beneficiaries out there who we might not know about. So at least that's one process where we are getting to know more about beneficiaries. But I think point taken, it's part of the data management matters that we need to deal with in respect of all members and beneficiaries of all members, and keeping that up to date. And I think giving members a surety that if they do inform the administration of such matters, like you said, that it will be dealt with in confidentiality, but that at the end of the day it's about the benefit and the interest of the beneficiaries. So I think as part of the education campaign, this probably needs to be enhanced.
Is there something you can do in a culturally sensitive way that informs beneficiaries that you can't have more than one, that the information is confidential, that they may not want to share with their first partner, that they've got one or two others, that you're not going to give the first partner that information necessarily, but that the pension fund does allow you to actually leave your benefit to more than one partner. You're not encouraging them the way it's out, so that there are members, presumably you think, that, you know, you'll only give the one partner. And because it's happening, you're not encouraging it, kindly. The thing is that partners 2 and 3 and 4 lose out. And it's not right, it's not fair. In every case I've dealt with, it's been like that. That's all I'm saying. But it's complex. We're alerting you to a responsibility you may have in a sensitive way, in a pragmatic way, to do something about this if you can. Okay, right. Over to the next answer.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly know that. I'd like to call on my colleague, the Chief Risk Officer, just to address the issues of fraud within Japan and just to give some comments on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jefferson. As the Japan, we do have an internal governance structure. We do have internal audit, which is fully functional. We also have the risk management unit, which deals with enterprise risk management side and the fraud and forensic management side. Now, we have implemented a fraud prevention and integrity framework that is obviously advocated by the GPSA. And the framework is aimed at anti-corruption and ethics training. We create awareness amongst both our internal and external stakeholders. Internal meaning the staff, we do conduct awareness sessions because I think in every corruption there must be a corrupt and a corruptee. So we try to encourage our staff not to obviously solicit any bribe and so forth. And from an external point of view, whenever there are roadshows held, we do attend to those roadshows and then we take awareness to our members. I think we also take note that there is obviously more that we can do from an advocacy part in terms of targeting employer departments. We have recently conducted investigations and identified certain employee departments that we could target and introduce those awareness trainings. And then as part of the prevention, improvement on internal controls is what we strive to achieve. So we have conducted our fraud risk assessment. We have conducted our operational risk assessment to ensure that we do create awareness to our staff and make sure that they do indicate to us or highlight to us any deficiencies in the process, and then we can obviously investigate some cases as they come up. We also do participate in the modernization space by identifying any controls that needs to be improved. I think with the enhancement of e-channel, like the CEO pointed out, we are now able to trace back to the members who actually HIV defrauded the JIPA. And then we do also have a whistleblowing mechanism. Now that is part of the detection. Whenever a member or a staff member identified that there is fraud that could occur or has occurred, they can phone our ethics hotline, which is managed by an external service provider. We also do have strategic partnerships with your Crime Intelligence Unit, your FABS. We have also recently created a partnership with the different forensic units within the bank. So whenever we identify or we pick up any potential fraud in a bank account, we can alert them and then maybe they could put a stop to it before we could investigate. So those are the interventions that we have introduced to make sure that we minimize the fraud and corruption at a stage. I think that we also pick up on the recent investigations that spousal benefit is one of the areas where they target because of the multiple spouses. Somebody would default, and then we pick up at later stage that we actually paid an incorrect spouse. So it's one of those things that we try and encourage our staff to identify, refer to our section, and then we can investigate before we could pay out the money. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman, if there's no follow-up questions to that, we'll go to my colleague Katie Bonin just to update us in terms of the call center and the outreach program and just to provide members with an update on that aspect.
Thank you, Chair. Regarding the client outreach program, we actually receive the commentary of prevention is better than cure, because currently we do have a strategy that is a proactive manner of engaging our clients through our outreach programs. And part of this, the CLO has alluded to the fact that we do have, the CLOs are on board to engage our employed partners. We currently have the mobile offices that we've done, and we're actually calculating the statistics of the mobile offices that we've had from the period of April to date, and realize that we've, engaged over 58,000 walk-ins in a period of 5 months due to these mobile offices. And we've also done the HR forums, the roadshows, and the retirement member campaign. There's a difference between the roadshows and the retirement member campaign, where the roadshows only target, the retirement member campaigns only target the members that are about to retire from the age of 58 upwards, and the roadshow targets the whole population in the province. And so far this year, we've actually done quite a number of provinces. We've been to Botswana in Free State, we've been to Freiburg in Northwest, we've been to Concordia in the Northern Cape, we've been to Mabatu in the Northwest again, we've been to Malawi and Kwamhlanga, we've been to Newcastle last week, and on that note, we will be here in the Western Cape next week on the 18th, on Friday for HR forums, and we will be in George on Saturday as a progress to reach that. We're also using the use of radio stations and community radio stations to partner with sending the messages that are in connection. And when we look at the link between the number of the calls and the activities within the call centers and within the regional offices, we can actually link it to the success of the outreach that these campaigns that we've had. So the outreach campaigns have been quite successful in educating our members. And over and above that, we also do partner with other organs of the state, which is your SARS, your FSV, and your DMSIVA. We collaborate with them, call them a board, and assist us in educating our members. And also, what is also encouraging to note is we've also looked at the broader perception of how we can extend that. We've engaged, for example, with Department of what is this department? Oh, I forgot. But we are actually doing the outreach with them, whether it was the co location to actually engage and provide the visibilities of the members. And also the premier's offices that we've engaged with different departments have actually allowed us the platform to partner with them and also not only use a single platform from Jakarta to do the outreach but also do with part of the roadshows. And we might as well say that it has been quite a success in doing the outreach when we see the number of inquiries that we receive and the call activities and the regional activities are a lot of our outreach programs. Department of Correctional Services, that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
colleague. Our colleague Mongezi will then talk to the question of the military pensions.
Maybe I should also talk about the COINA, the compensation fund. Otherwise, the question is regarding that and the relationship between the GPAA and the fund. In, with respect to state employees, the state ensures the state employees through the budget vote of the national treasurer. I think it's how it ends. If an employee is injured on duty or dies on duty, the employee has an obligation to report to the employer, and in turn the employer lodges a claim to the compensation fund. The fund issues an award to the bar, of which that award is an instruction to pay. Currently, we pay annuities of plus minus 9,000 members of our state employees, the value of about 200 million. Military pensions, the SANDF, MK and APLA, and all those that apply for military pensions, the benefits are all the same. There is no difference between the SANDF beneficiary or a member. The Military Pensions Act was promulgated in 1976 and it hasn't really changed, and therefore the benefit structure as well is the same. So whether you apply as an SAN staff or any other formation, you still receive the same benefits.
I'm worried about that piece of legislation that was promulgated in 1976. Because currently there's a debate about, for instance, the inclusion of the CARE Corps. And the CARE Corps. CARE Corps was part of the forces that the South African Defense Force was using prior 1994, and they were demobilized. And so we are sitting with that challenge of a military force that was never compensated. But apart from that, and I'm not taking it back to the pension fund. I want us to get a legislation that actually compensated people who were meeting out human rights violations, getting the same compensation. I don't know. But we need to look at the prescriptions of the legislation to whether it, the way it's structured. If you have been in the service for 10 years killing people, and get the same pension like a person who got freedom.
No, I do. Yeah, morally, there's no question, Tani. It makes my blood boil actually every time I think about that. But this is what your leadership and the leader of the opposition negotiated in 1994 as part of this negotiated transition, right? But you, I'm very clear, very clear. There's a whole lot of issues about this transition that actually are highly questionable, and as you see out there with the protests and other issues arising, these issues are surfacing again by the new generation, right? I was saying, what did you people really negotiate? And the opposition is too insensitive to some of these things in my view. I'm not referring to individuals, but it's also not helping, it polarizes things. And I think that's going to come back to haunt us. That aspects of the negotiation, we're correct, we have no choice.
Yeah.
Other aspects of the negotiations, I think the majority in this country went too far. That's my view. I've said it in many platforms, I'm not saying anything new. Tani, those things I'm very clear about. I'm very clear about. And I can tell you some anecdotes about, well, let me tell you. So, Tani, we're on the same page. But let's be clear,
this falls under another committee as well, right? Defense, the military, veterans, and so on. These issues we can raise within Pandi in our own capacity, Kavang, and so on. But as far as the patients go, these guys, I mean, these people, our guys, is partly my children, have been implemented, right? There's not much we're going to be able to do about that unless the policy changes are made elsewhere. So nothing stops members here from canvassing and so on. And we can, when we come to a time where we have the space at the time, these issues we might raise as a committee. We won't all agree on these issues, but, well, the democracy, the majority will prevail, and we'll take these things forward. Let's keep that on the back burner, but in the meanwhile, I think in our individual ways, we should raise this. Over to the next answer, please.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Chair. I'll just hand over to my colleague, Jay, just to talk on the issue of the 45 days in terms of the turnaround times. And also there was a request from the Honorable Member in terms of specifics for withdrawals, if you can just comment on those two.
Honorable Chair, the question was around the fact that there was 45 days of withdrawals and how long did it take. The 45 days is actually from the time we receive it till the time paid. That's within 45 days is what our target is set at. And that's how we evaluate our performance in terms of receipt of complete documentation to have a payment. And that is our performance criteria. And so we've been trying to measure ourselves to continuously improve ourselves on a yearly basis. The statutory requirement in terms of paying our benefits is 60 days in terms of the law, and we've actually gone beyond that in terms of saying let's start to improve the quality of our service delivery, and therefore we've set a target for 45 days for this financial year. The next financial year we'll set even a further target of reduction in terms of time spent so that we improve service delivery going forward. So I think that was the one question that was referred to.
The request for the statistics for the withdrawals on the monthly basis.
So I don't have the exact numbers with me, but we can provide that. But just on a whole, we've had an increase in resignations since last year, July, all the way through to this year, in this current financial year. So on average, we receive between 7,000 and 9,000 returns a month. I don't have the exact numbers, but we will provide that information. It varies month to month, and it's difficult to remember each of these numbers.
But we will forward those that information to the G5A checkers and that. Yes, absolutely committed. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, it was also the question of the unclaimed benefits. The chairperson, honorable chairperson, also spoke about the possibility of engaging with other parties, etc. We'd certainly be very happy to be involved in that. I think this is an issue that we need to resolve. I would like to ask my chief financial officer from Zira just to comment in terms of the other questions on the unclaimed benefits, please.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. There are two reasons for unclaimed benefits. So much origin. One is that when member passes away, they leave beneficiaries. And those beneficiaries, most of the time, were registered as young, as 2 years, 3 years. They have no contact details or nothing. Now, as to her, is our responsibility to chase them. As I was saying, there are two main reasons which makes it better on unclaimed benefits. It's the fact that unclaimed benefits are coming from beneficiaries. Beneficiaries are left by a member. Thanks, Mr. Sergei. As I was saying, the beneficiaries which are left by members registered in our books when they were 2 years, when they were 3 years. This person has passed on. Now we need to go and place actual individual users. Really becomes a bit challenging to us. That's number one. The second one is the nature of the people of South Africa who work in different areas. If you look at the police, nurses, teachers, they are not working at home. They work in different areas. And once a person retires or resigns, now then he goes home. And now we have to go and check this person. His address is where he went. No, not the home address. And it is a bit challenging for us now when it comes to trying to link the work address which the person has left to home, where in most instances we don't even know where home is, eventually checking. That's the reason why tipping and tipping is a bit high. And the second question which some of the members asked, one of the members asked, was the classification or how we categorize this and claim benefits. As I've indicated, the teacher mainly, the nurses, the police, those three people. And the last one are beneficiaries. These are just unpaid benefits in our case. The rest are people we can quickly track, we are trading them, we're finding them, we're paying them. But these are the key ones we will be paying.
The teachers, police, and
the others, we'll be tracking them. As we speak, if I'm looking at Pegasus March, 2015, we're sitting with a balance of 574 million rand in unclaimed benefits, which we're tracing every day in Japan. In Japan, we have links with Home Affairs, we have links with the IDT, ITC, this debt-related ITC. The last one, there's a service provider helping us to physically trace these people. As I've indicated, that when you talk about beneficiaries as well as teachers of left place of work, you need to physically trace them where they are now. So we've got the service provider helping us on that. And secondly, quarterly, we have got shows for other methods within the benefits of Japan. Unclaimed benefits is part to that. It is in trying to reach the provinces and locate the people which we have to pay. I think I answered the Honorable Chair.
To what extent is related to people who may be withdrawing because they're unhappy about Vodacom Shell or other forms of so-called abuse by government to subsidize SOEs who are faltering?
I'm going to share it to you. I'll ask Dr. Sabiso just to comment on that.
Can I follow up on the previous answer?
Yeah.
Huh? No. Should I do it now?
Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'm going to respond on the reasons why people are withdrawing. I think in 2014, Chair, when this phenomenon was growing, we went to some education districts to find, because it was the prevalence was very, very high in education to teachers. That's why the trend is still continuing in terms of in education. We spoke to people that Honorable Member had to say they left and went, come back. Now, there were few reasons. We spoke to people at the district level. We spoke to educators in terms of that particular study. These are some of the reasons that the Honorable said that they've advanced. One, they said it was the limitation of the JEP law, government pension employee law, to provide added benefits and flexibility in the bank structure. Two, they said it was a crisis plan. Two, they said the prospect of business venture, people just thought that they'll get the money and start business. Three, the exploitation of the holes in the government system in such that a person can resign and come back. There was no doja in that. It's only now that some of the departments are now saying a person should have at least a cooling clause. You cannot resign and come back. The other reason was the question of members, trying to be informed in terms of that, about their benefits, as they were ill-informed. And then another reason was that exclusion of children from monthly benefits. I think that's one of the things that people are raising to say if you are ex-spouse and so on, if you don't have a spouse or a partner, you lose. I think that was some of the things that was said earlier. And then the other one was the point they said it was also because of the negative perceptions which was felt by the public discourse. Now, Honorable Chair, to sum up what one of the participants said, he said, I quote, when you start to work, you must start supporting your family first, and when you are done that, you find you have nothing but your colleagues have progressed. You then check that is what is the way, grab the money, buy a car, or do something else, whatever, and then come back and work. They grab the money, I will still continue, they grab the money, pay the debt, go home and build a house. Some of them don't even go home. They arrange with the principal that they want to volunteer on their former post, and they come back soon. So I think that's one of the reasons. So open-endedness was one of the reasons that people were that it was not the question of pension reforms. It was the question of saying, I'm having here's the money, I can see it on the benefit statement, why can't I then grab it and use it? Thank you, Honourable.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. My follow-up is on unclaimed funds. I know I don't hold the same view, not necessarily that I don't hold the same view with my group. I want to illustrate, it might be different with GIPA because in the mining sector, you had a juristic person of another country having an earlier name of a South African persona working in the mining sector. And then when they go home, they don't use the same name that they were using when they're in South Africa, therefore they can't benefit. That's why the mining sector is sitting with billions. So at least you are just 900 something million. It's not a big issue for distribution. But I assume in the long run, if you try through all the campaigns and everything to distribute the money, but you still left with a portion that accrues interest anyway on a daily basis in the bank. Even if you don't answer me now, but that money, you can donate it too much back to the revenue funds. You know? And we use it for other programs. There's so many programs in that. And I don't want to answer it now because once Makosi said it's the lowest threshold in the hierarchy, I shall be enough to the knuckles for saying for people who must not. I'm not saying that. Because it can be that there will be some money remaining. When both the member and the spouse and the children are not traceable, whether they died, it happens in a family, everybody dies, and then you can't trace this person. And we shouldn't even assume that in government there's only professionals in this category of services. There's auxiliary services, like people who photocopy papers, the sweepers, and so on. All those directors who work in government might not be so well informed, or their partners be so well informed, you know. And then what happens to that category in an event that they are not treatable? And this money accruing interest on a daily basis in the bank, and maybe that interest, but I'm interested in the interest check. If you can give that interest first, I don't know.
On this point that Sandy is raising, I'm not going to comment on it because I made myself clear. I really do think we have not done enough to trace the beneficiaries, and it's because, I mean, I've never come across, maybe even in the Ilanga newspaper where they are, you know, a list of people to say who knows these are following people or something like that. I have never seen that. I know many administrators of funds, they claim to have tracing units, but I don't see that, especially the community radio stations and so forth, because they're cheaper. You know, to actually advertise in those things, much cheaper. Those are some of the avenues that we should try and get before we can decide, before you can decide what to do, and anyone did that, people who actually invested for their families to get that money. But Chair, the thing that he is saying, which is very interesting, and I want us to note it. You know, for it's the first time today, I've noticed that if you go to rural areas, suddenly there's been this new massive house built. And people, if to build a house in a rural areas, because it's not, you actually have, probably if you like, you have permission to occupy a piece of home, or it's just communal land, you know, and so you will not get a mortgage for that. So many people will actually take that money and go and build a house at home, get a home. I mean, I've seen this in Bumalanga, I've seen it in KwaZulu-Natal, I've seen it in a lot of rural areas. And I think it explains the thing that we're talking about here, that other people feel that, anyway, you know, I have this money, I might as well build this home for my family, even if whatever happens to me, I will have a home there. And that is something that I think you guys must really find a way of looking at, and judging from what you were saying about that gentleman, though you are talking about cars and what have you, but it tells you about that middle class, the upcoming black middle class, which is a problem, because that's your constituency largely.
So the question was, if you resign as a teacher, what usually happens? You get your job back within what space of time? You know. Secondly, in the form that you have, do you actually, you know, when you give people the amount, it looks like a hell of a lot. Do you have things at the bottom that alert people to like, well, I don't know how you put it, crudely, there's a lot of money, but if you lose out, you withdraw, and blah, blah, blah. So that they get the amount, but they also get a precaution at the bottom. Without being like prescriptive, right? Do you do that sort of thing?
Yeah,
on your form, like, yeah,
Fanny? Yeah, people ask us because I have a thing that we might be okay at in terms of the question, because people take voluntary service packages, they do them to the departments that they're working for, and then GPA just process what has been before them. So I would suggest to you that let's rather have, I don't know, because there's so many departments, how we're going to do it. To have a discussion based on this element of many resignations, to engage other departments to try and after the endeavor that you propose, maybe after it, we report to all other committees to try and come with a remedial action to try and curb. Because
you're right.
There's no way when someone says, I want to resign, and it has been approved, that the pension fund will not process it.
No. I agree.
So, I don't know what I get
the point. See, what I'm asking is, one of the things people are saying here is that people get, like, we get annual thing, right? Members of Parliament at the end of, I think, 1 month here, told this is the value of your pension. Presumably, the members of your fund do get a notice, whether it's 6 monthly or monthly or yearly. In that notice, if you tell them how much money you've got, do you put certain things as a possible? To suggest to them that, okay, maybe, I don't know how to put it, it sounds a hell of a lot, but you lose enormously if you were to resign and then even come back. Do you have something that gently steer them, nudge them, rather, towards not resigning? That's all I'm asking.
Yeah. Can I answer the question? Because I think I understand what you're asking. Yeah. Something like that says that your total benefit is 5 million taxable and 40%, and the calculation is made so that the individual can see how much tax will be... So that they see the negative impact thereof, especially when it relates to a lump sum payment, that's going to be me. Yeah, I'm just... I'm adding so when they answer.
Thanks, Jeff. I just have one small question regarding the research that was done. Did it look at the demographic profile of the people who are resigning. An example has been made of teachers and nurses mostly because they can get back into the system probably more. But what about other demographic issues? Are they mostly in rural or urban or semi-urban areas? Are they mostly in the professional skills or semi-skills? Because it matters in terms of how what percentage of those people can be reabsorbed into the job market. And those who can't be absorbed then fall into the unemployed category. And eventually, they are going to affect the social wage, which is already high. They are going to apply for old age pensions eventually. And also, if people resign, the age group at which they resign, do they, if a 45-year-old resigns and then he or she cannot be absorbed back into the job market, then it's also another problem. So it adds to the social problems, but also to the financial problems and the economic problems of the country. So I just want to know, do we know, do we have like the demographics of those people? Thanks.
As I was saying before, my interpreter Tanzi came in. She was very good, by the way. What I want to say is, so basically, you just, I was going to ask something that I've gotten now, but it was something to do with, look, given the economic challenges the country has, right, do you anticipate, you know, you're saying that cost of living is going to increase dramatically, drought, et cetera, right? Aren't people going to be under more pressure? And isn't there going to be a sort of bigger thrust towards resignations? Do you anticipate that, or do you think that the hubbub around that has passed for whatever reason? Secondly, did anybody suggest to you in any way that the reason they want to resign and take the money is because they're unhappy with a government rescue state-owned entity?
Thank you, Chairman, for those discussions. On the question of data, we will forward to you, along with the other information you requested, the list of resignations by province, by sector, by service, and by age. So we will include that information in the pack that that we will send you. That information is available. I'll just ask my colleague, Dr. Sufisa, just to answer the last question in respect of the concerns of members in terms of resignations.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. What we conducted here was actually a pilot. The study still continues because we were so concerned to say, because the prevalence was also more in education than in other sectors. Yes, the recognition is very high, as was indicated before in the presentation, that in your police, you are education and nurses and so on. However, this prevalence of recognition was very, very high in education. Now, what was also come up is that in terms of education, the education department then put a clause of saying that this, I know for instance in Pumala, they said at least you need to take three months before you can get re-employed. But the most important thing people wanted to say, they wanted to meet some of the immediate needs in terms of the resignation, and then the age, as the age ranges somewhere relatively at 40, but some where people were at the age of retiring, in terms of, instead of people retiring, they would opt for resignation. However, through the roadshows, that is discouraged. It's part of the presentation that my colleague has indicated that discouraged people from doing that. Thank you. Not at all.
Can leave and then come back within a week.
I wouldn't have an answer for that one. But we did not find that people were sensitive. It was because of people were state, but actually subsidizing other entities. It was not found.
I'm just trying to look up. A teacher resigns, right? In general, how long does it take before they take the money and then they go back to work again?
Honourable Chair, maybe I can answer that question more effectively. So, as I said earlier on, the trend of resignation started sometime in July last year. And with the analysis that we've been busy doing, we noted that certain provinces allowed teachers to come back, as an example. And then when we raise this matter in the media and we've had discussions on the high resignation rates in public sector, we noted that the various provincial administrators, including the premier's offices, they put a stop to this practice of allowing members to resign and come back immediately. So we know instances where in certain provinces, like Mpumalanga as an example, where the premier's office then took a step to say, you will not employ a teacher if he's left up within a cooling period of 3 months. So they're putting controls in place to allow for that cooling period to happen before a teacher could come. So that stopped the trend of resignations in certain provinces. Sure, all provinces did not abide that rule, and therefore we still find that in certain provinces, members are still resigning and coming back. It is not within a few days' time. Naturally, they wait for the pension to get paid, and then they come in again. So that is a general trend that we've noted as far as members are concerned in terms of these resignations.
I liked everything that really the former speaker has said, but only wanted to request the colleague here to assist in making sure that he pronounces Mpumalanga correctly, because that is the word we say. Not Mpumalanga, it's Mpumalanga. That's my problem. Check, I just wanted to indicate that things that we're discussing now, we have recommended or suggested that they do, but also want to comment on what they're saying, that Mpumalanga is doing this. It's not only Mpumalanga, because I've heard on radio, the Department of Basic Education nationally is only coming to say they want to put also the strict measures on the requirements for appointment of these teachers, so that they are not a priority. They are bagging on experience, because some experience has been there, and there are new teachers that are coming in, I'll be the preferred one. So they are trying to work that on. That's why I was saying you need integral program so that we assist each other.
Chair, I was going to make a suggestion that we park this matter, because there's a sensitivity about it, because my past experience is that there was a leakage in this segment of profession where teachers and social workers were not enough in the country, where at one point there was a campaign to recruit teachers and social workers because there was a leakage. So the reason why I'm saying my part, I want us to thoroughly engage the portfolio committee on basic education and higher education, because they will give us clear challenges that they were faced with. And I'm saying this because in my constituents, the schools that did not have teachers that operated with temporary teachers that were not part of the system, they were not paid because they were not yet absorbed. So it's a multi-pronged challenge. It's a challenge of this issue of misperceptions, but on the other hand, it then feeds into the crisis of now having the professionals that are needed in the system, like your doctors, your nurses, and so on. So I suggest that we pack it and then we engage, so that when we make a final recommendation to the pension fund, we have taken this data into account. It's admissible, Chair. Yeah.
Just want to be absolutely sure. So would I be correct that you have no evidence, and that no evidence in your survey suggested that any of the withdrawals over the past year were at all related to, let's put this delicately, confidence in the pension fund's investment strategy and their investment, their perceived investment in risky assets like state-owned enterprises, especially in Eskom?
Dr. Sufisa, if you can just confirm that. Honorable Chair, Honorable Member, definitely we don't have evidence. We still have to find that.
I'm ready to do this. Ask the same question where you have asked us before. Mm. It's not answered. Administration is
because I need to know the rules. Yeah, the thing is that out of here, some latitude. There's no rule or mechanical way. I don't think, I thought it was good that he asked again, because once again he got the same answer, and that made it more stuck to him, more glaring to him,
more obvious to him, more direct to him, more precise to him. And what he was saying was utterly nonsensical. It could only be a sliver, a small sliver of people in his constituency, presumably, who feel that way. And they wouldn't say it either, which shows that he's got a battle to find the evidence. But we wish him well. He's got Saturday and Sunday and weekends ahead to work on that. Okay, over to you. And now let's move on. I think because we have this Indaba as Tandi in our policies, no one asked us to use the word Indaba. But okay, we call it Indaba. Fine. It'll be now an Indaba. It will be a workshop. It'll be very big. The masses will be here. But fine. That's what we're going to do. Over to you. Can you talk in the next 10 minutes?
Chairman, my apologies. Honorable Chairman, if I could just ask my colleague Jake to comment on two issues then. The issue of the benefit statements that you raised and also the issue of the cost per member of the month. And then I can follow that up.
Honorable Chair, so we do issue benefit statements on a yearly basis. There is a disclaimer advising members of what they need to do in terms of the benefits that are shown on benefit statement, and we are announcing on a yearly basis the benefit statement. So for this current financial year, we haven't issued it simply because of the fact that we've seen a higher resignation rate, and so we cautioned the fund about it, and so the fund is under considering how we should add more value to the benefit statement so that members do take the appropriate decision when they do resign and when they do see the benefits. As far as the cost per administration per member per month is concerned, for the last financial year, the average cost for all services, including that of which relates to modernization, amounted to just less than 40 rands per member per month. And so these included all the outreach programs that we do in terms of road shows, the mobile offices that we purchase, the client liaison offices that we have, the infrastructure that we have in terms of the provincial offices, including the satellite offices, as well as the program that we have embarked in terms of modernization, where we are improving our systems and automation of our systems to allow us to be able to be more effective in terms of the service delivery of our organization. 1.28 million.
Thank you, Chairman. There were a number of issues that I've made notes on that we haven't really dealt in great detail. One of those key issues was the investment strategy. The investment strategy is really run by GPF in collaboration with the PIC. So our mandate is really in terms of the administration of the fund. So we wouldn't be in an ideal position to comment on the skinness or otherwise of the assets in terms of the GPF investment strategy. I think the other key issue that honourable members have raised, is the whole question of indebtedness and what role can we play. And as was pointed out earlier, one of the consequences is that we find out too late. We're in the administration process, and so we have to pay those claims within a certain period. So unfortunately, it's a bit too late to stop that payment when it comes to us. We also have to be mindful, I think one honourable member raised the question about one-on-one chatting to members. We don't have a license to do financial planning. In terms of the Act, one would have to sit down with a member, go through the member's financial history, and note all the member's assets and liabilities in order to be able to advise the member accordingly. It could be for the specific member's circumstances that cashing in the benefits and paying a debt where you're paying 25-30% interest might be the ideal thing. So we're saying overall, the high resignation rate is detriment to the member and, of course, to the economy, but we're not in that position. We don't have the mandate legislatively to be able to give financial advice to solve it. But what's important is that we can participate with other parties in the education program and increasing financial literacy amongst our members. Obviously, the first prize is to stop that indebtedness, and that we rely on other acts such as the National Credit Act to make sure that members don't get overextended and they can only take debt that they can afford. So some of this is really outside our control, but what in our control is that we can work hand in glove with GPF and yourselves to increase and improve financial literacy and encourage our members to stay in the system. That we can do. I don't see any other points which we haven't covered. I think all the other points raised by honourable members were covered in some form or the other.
It was just a question of SARS, SARS collaboration, and what would be the safeguards from SARS side in terms of the confidentiality of that, and the local authority question about whether we would see ourselves getting involved in local authority funds. I'll ask Dr. Clifford to, and mindful of the time, just to briefly comment on both of those.
Honourable Dean members, look at the, as far as SARS and the data is concerned, we obviously with the Interfaces Forum, we've got about 13 entities, including the banks, to make sure that we can get to a point where we could work together to get data and use common data together without interfering with different policies and also being outside of legislation. So that is a feasibility study is ongoing at the moment. And CPAA are actually leading the business continuity area of that. In the finance cluster, we're working together with the other professionals and also with RCT agents to see how we can also combat the cyber crime threat that may be imposing on also on our front. So that's as far as the sharing of data is concerned. It's an ongoing feasibility study. The second point then on the new business, taking on the local government and the local government sphere. Through our modernization program now that we're working towards a point where we can actually bring the cost of per head for administration down by taking on other government business. So I think the administrator is quite geared and will be quite geared within 18 months to take on new business, which can, they could administrate other funds inside like we're doing with National Treasury as well. And it will also assist in bringing the cost per head in that fashion. It will bring that down as well. So there's a win-win in that as well.
We have our own capital.
I think we're more or less done, right? Unless there are other things. Other things to carry over, we'll continue. You would have had within 7 days any outstanding questions that you haven't answered. And answers to the questions. Also, if you want to very so add to what you've done, please do. I just need members to, in 2 minutes, tell me what are we going to do now. We more or less have a direction for the unclaimed benefits. Colleagues, can you have a comment? What are we going to do about these resignations? What can we do about it? We can't continue to talk about it. We have to do something. So, can I ask members at the next meeting next Tuesday? We've got, it's likely to be the FFC with its annual report. The first 15 minutes or something in the, can you remind me, 15 minutes, 10 minutes to assess what are we going to do? So we act on these things, bearing in mind that we are only one actor among many, but to play our role and persuade others to do so. Having said that, thanks very much. Please remember Friday.
Thank you.